When Eugenides paused in the entranceway to the lesser throne room, those closest to him halted their conversations, puzzled to see a stranger in the doorway, then shocked when they recognized him. He looked older and unfamiliar after his absence. He'd had the barber clip his hair short again, and his right arm was hidden in a sling. As the court looked him over, silence spread away from the bottom of the stair into the throne room like a wave through a small pond, and he stood immobilized by the stairs.
At least the harvest was good.
Yeah, I heard it was pretty good this year.
Cold out, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You're listening to the Aetolian Archives, the Queen's Thief podcast for all you rereaders and nitpickers.
I'm Noelle.
And I'm Caitlin.
It's January 27th, 2019, which means that Return of the Thief is in only 51 days.
That number just keeps getting smaller.
Funny how that works. We interrupt this podcast we recorded yesterday to bring you breaking news. This morning on her Tumblr, Megan Whalen-Turner announced that Return of the Thief has in fact been pushed to summer of 2020. There were some rumblings about it on Twitter last night, some rumors. I was frantically emailing people from the bookstore that I work at, like, do you know anything about this? But we did get confirmation this morning from Megan on her Tumblr. It's not gonna be for a while, so let's all hunker down for the renewed long wait for book 6. Alright, back to the episode, I guess.
Today, we're discussing The Queen of Aetolia, Chapter 5, in which Jen gets out of bed, Aetolia can't quite bring herself to get into hers, and an incidental minor character called Kamet comes into play.
Kamet! We're so excited. We have been waiting for him to show up. I thought that he showed up in like chapter 3 or 4.
Yeah, the last few episodes you've been like, oh, Kamet's coming next. And then it hasn't been, but now he's here.
There are a bunch of different things going on in this chapter. The alternating perspectives are kind of in full swing now, which is cool because you can see parallels between what's going on in Jen's world and what's going on in Natalia's world. There are these clear similarities that are happening. Both of them are spending a lot of time alone in their bedrooms. Mm-hmm. They're sitting up at night looking out the window. Both are feeling isolated and haunted in some way. And so they're having these parallel experiences
to the same event.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah, reaction to the
you
same
have
event.
To- This is what we're all supposed to be inferring from this, is that, like, why would Aetolia be, excuse me, I have bronchitis. Sorry for the coughing.
Yeah, Caitlin just is an American hero and is recording this podcast despite being nearly incapacitated.
No, I'm no longer contagious anymore. Nobody worry for Noelle's health. They're fine.
The germs are not going to come through the ether into your house. Through the microphone wires. That's how that works, isn't it?
Also, Edis and Aetolia are already at war in this chapter, but Jen just doesn't know about it.
Right, and we know about it because we have read ahead like little cheaters. But there's nothing to indicate in this chapter that there's a war going on.
Well, there are a few of those little hints that later Edith says, like, oh, you could have seen, but you just shut your eyes. Like, it's mentioned in here, like, a military messenger is riding out.
Right!
And he doesn't, like, show any curiosity about that. And then he goes to find the map weights when he's about to relearn how to write because he needs weights to hold the paper down,
and there are only a couple map weights left. Oh my gosh, I've never thought about that before.
Yeah, those are the things he was kind of not curious about because he was wrapped up in his own struggle, but he didn't think to wonder, why is the queen too busy to come see me except for every 2 weeks?
And nobody in the court wants to talk to him about it. And that's part of why, like, he actually leaves his room in this chapter and he goes to a couple of court dinners, and at the dinners Everybody is just sitting in painful silence until someone talks about the weather. And that's a general awkwardness around him. But also, I think people don't want to talk to him about the war.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're searching desperately for anything else to say.
Like, we never find this out, but is the reason they don't bring up the war the fact that they know he doesn't know about it yet and they don't want to let him in on it because that's not, like, their place? Or do they assume he knows about it and they just don't want to bring it up because he's the cause? Mm. It could be either.
No one knows how to react to Jen
mm-hmm.
right now.
Yeah.
He's almost like a ghost
yeah.
walking around. And I think people expect that he will never be involved in politics or in court life really again.
Mm-hmm.
And that he will always kind of exist in this limbo state now. And so it maybe doesn't even occur to people to talk to him about the war because that's no longer relevant to him, even though mm-hmm. it's about him.
Yeah, that could be it. Later in the chapter, when a tailor comes to fit him for new clothes so he can go down to dinner, for a brief paragraph, the narration is from the tailor's point of view, just going over the rumors that he had heard about Eugenides, saying that he'd probably die soon, and the whole city grieving as if he were already gone, and that vicious bitch of Atolia to blame. So, I think we can infer from this that no one thinks he's gonna, like, make it out of this.
Yeah.
They think he's either dying or, like, a wreck forever.
And Jen has become a symbol of Odyssean victimhood at the hands of Atolia.
Yeah.
That vicious bitch of Atolia, which 8 to 12 age range, ladies and gentlemen. Let's just mention that one more time.
Yeah, if we're not mistaken, this is the first instance of actual profanity used in the series, which I think just really, like, that's another tonal shift. The series really does not have that much profanity at all, but, like, this is just mm-hmm. an indication of this is how strongly the Odysseans feel about Atolia at this point.
And the stakes have been raised in general.
Right, yeah.
An image that I find really interesting in this sequence with Jen and the continuation of his recovery is he finally gets up and he starts poking around his desk, and it says he stood up to poke at the papers at the back of the desk, but the medical detritus took up too much space for there to be any room for sorting. At some point, ink had spilled across the text he'd been copying, obscuring the left half of a long paragraph. And so Jen is so consumed by this event that he can't look forward or backward. Everything that he had been doing before, the text that he'd been copying has had ink spilled all over it, and he can't see his desk because there's pills and medications and bandages. He can't see his life anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It has all been disrupted. And that the tragedy and the change has come into this place, which was a safe space for him.
Yeah.
Right, let's move on to Atolia, who is also hanging around being sad for most of this. Even though she obviously knows there's a war going on because she's the one waging it.
Mm-hmm.
But in her parts of this chapter, there's also no mention of it.
Yeah, you only see her preoccupied with Eugenides throughout the entire chapter.
Yeah. And it's her very, like, private, insular life.
Yeah. And we also see that this preoccupation of hers is seen as unusual in Huzrush's mm-hmm. eyes. He sneaks into a meeting she's having with Relius without being announced, and he hears the end of her conversation with Relius about the thief, and is he recovering, and what's he doing? And then later, when Huzrush is talking to Kamet, he says, will tell the Emperor that we hope her preoccupation with her Edesian thief lasts while we work. Also, just kind of interesting that at this point in the text, he's called her Edesian thief. Like, that made me stop for a minute in this reread. Interesting.
We had talked at the beginning of this book about the idea of performance in this book specifically, and thinking about when is Atolia performing and who is she performing for. And I think that this scene with Nehushtaresh, where he sneaks in, is a really good example of that, because she's so happy to see him. She lets him kiss her hand. She's very receptive to him. And there's nothing, even in her presumably in perspective narration, to indicate that she is suspicious of him in any way until the very, very end of that scene, when she low-key tells Relius to figure out how the hell he got into the room unannounced.
Yeah.
And so we know only subtly that she is aware that he might be working against her. And it's so, like, her performance is so pervasive that it's even difficult to see from her point of view.
Yeah. In her narration, it says how the Mede ambassador was a remarkably attractive man, she thought, or he would be were it not for his beard, etc. Like, what we get from her is that just that she finds the Mede ambassador attractive. And that's something that Megan uses throughout the book to try to kind of throw us off the scent of, like, that's mentioned in Atolia's thoughts over and over again, but then you find out later, like,
yeah, she's pulling one over on us.
Yeah.
I do think...
Very clever.
I think that Megan Wayland-Turner cheats just a little bit in this one. Because normally, the withheld information in the narration is because somebody is telling their own story and they're choosing to withhold something from us, or there's something that we're not seeing for kind of an in-universe reason. But this book is all third-person shifting point of view.
Omniscient.
And so when we don't know something, it's because the author has decided not to give it to us. And so she can kind of play fast and loose and trick you in a way that does feel a little bit like, okay, to me.
Something else in this scene we get that's very intriguing is Atolia tells Nehushtaresh and Relius, I met his grandfather once many years ago, meaning Eugenides' grandfather, the previous Edesian thief. He told me that a thief's greatest asset, like a queen's, was his mind.
Another Jen Atolia parallel.
Also, I would love a short story about that. She says, they met when she was a princess of no particular importance. She wasn't even queen.
Write that then. Fan fiction, people.
Yeah,
I want it on my desk by Monday. One other detail that I like here is at the very beginning of Atolia's bit in this chapter, it mentions that during the summer, she can hear the wheels of farmers' carts from her bedroom window because the windows are open, which is just another little detail that emphasizes how small these places are. These are little city-states. Her palace is right next to just the road. Her bedroom window, she can hear the road where people are walking around and doing stuff. And so there's like this contrast between this really opulent and isolated palace life, which is very real, and also how close it is to everybody else.
Yeah.
And so I guess what I take away from that is how constructed and maybe even fragile these social systems are.
Yeah. Lastly from this scene is she explains that Eugenides is... title is hereditary, and she says it could go to the child of one of his sisters. So previously, we had read that and we had kind of thought that was more like hypothetical, but on this reread, I I think this means that at least two sisters of his do have actual children, because if it's a hereditary title, it could go to the child of his brothers also.
Mm-hmm.
So wouldn't you have said siblings? But so I think this means that Jen really is an uncle at this point, which is like...
Give me the sisters! Where are they?
We've talked... I don't want to spam you guys with our family longing, which I feel like we've been doing. But so we can move on now, but just another detail.
Here's our...
Finally picked up.
At least once an episode, yes. We have to say, please give us the sisters. Last but not least, Kemet. He's introduced as the secretary of the Mead ambassador, and you don't know that he's a slave at first. He's just the secretary.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that they have a very cordial relationship.
Yeah, that you get the sense, or I got the sense anyway, that, I don't know exactly how I want to put this. Like, they're on good terms. And he also, he inputs into the conversation. It does not read at first like a conversation between two very unequal people.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't read like the power dynamic is incredibly skewed.
But then all of a sudden we get, they don't have many slaves here. I could run away and make myself a free man, which is A, foreshadowing, and B, like a very disturbing thing, because Kemet says it as a joke, and then Nehushtaresh jokes back, oh, I'd find you. But obviously there's a tremendous threat.
Yeah.
In that exchange. And like all of a sudden the violence that's an undercurrent in this relationship becomes a little bit visible.
Right. Yeah, something I wanted to bring up about that is that Kemet's the one who brought that up, saying they don't have many slaves here, and then he's the one who actually made the joke, I could run away. Obviously, living that reality would be, like you said, there is a huge undercurrent of violence in their relationship, as we find out later. So joking about it might be a way for Kemet to kind of diffuse some of that tension. But
yeah.
Also, like, Kemet's relationship with Nehushtaresh, I feel like Kemet really has to... How do I put this? Like, he needs to feel like he has a good, cordial, friendly, loving relationship with Nehushtaresh in order to deal with this awful situation.
Yeah,
that
it's a survival tactic.
It's a survival mechanism. Right, it's a defense mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Like, mentally. For much of Thick as Thieves, or at least the beginning in the first half, his perspective on Nehushtaresh is kind of saying, like, oh, I know how to handle him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not as unequal as all that. Like, maybe he did beat me up, but, like, we had a lot of good times together. So, like...
Yeah, and making this joke is his way of... Because otherwise it might be, like an unspoken tension.
Right.
And he needs to make sure that I know that you know that I could think this, and I need you to know that I think it's ridiculous.
Right.
And we can joke about this, it's fine.
Yeah. You know, it's just too ridiculous to even imagine that I would run away. Just reinforcing, like, oh, I'm not going to run away.
Yeah.
Because we know from Thick as Thieves that he did really in earnest talk about running away with Layla.
Yeah.
And that's when Nehushtaresh almost killed him. So bringing this up as a joke is kind of like, you're safe, I'm not going to try it again. Measure.
Yeah,
I would almost say.
We're like, on good terms now.
Yeah.
The other really interesting thing about this conversation between Kemet and Nehushtaresh that we were talking about a little bit before we started recording is that when they're talking about the plans that they have, Nehushtaresh brings up the Baron Arundides, and he wants Kemet to ingratiate himself with the servants in Baron Arundides' household. And so our question is, what exactly was Nehushtaresh planning to do with Arundides? Because we know from King of Atolia that Arundides is like a large, wealthy household with a lot of land, mm-hmm. and that they're a big threat.
Yep. And so we were wondering if anything planned between Nehushtaresh and Arundides comes to fruition between now in King of Atolia when Jen... Or I guess, I mean, even past King of Atolia, because we know from the summary of Return of the Thief that Arendides is still
a threat. He's gonna come back!
Like, doing something.
Return of the Arendides!
Yeah.
What really makes me fall in love with Kamet on the reread is that Nehushtaresh says that Atolia has the most appealing of feminine virtues, especially in a queen. She's easily led. She's held the throne for some time, the secretary said, cautiously.
We know from Thick as Thieves that Nehushtaresh has enormously underestimated Kamet what seems to be their entire lives together. So this is another indication, first of all, that Kamet is more than he appears, and second of all, that...
And that Kamet is observant.
Yeah.
And shrewd. And he's observed the situation, and he knows that Atolia is a force to be reckoned with.
Mm-hmm.
And he can't say it, but he's storing that information away for a rainy day. That's chapter 5. Next week, Jen gets a message from the gods that changes, well, something.
Did you notice anything about this chapter that we didn't? Send us your comments, questions, thoughts. Chime in at AtolianArchives.tumblr.com.
Be blessed in your endeavors. Thank you for listening. This is an amateur embroidery production. Rate and review us on iTunes. Tell your friends. I know that we're definitely a niche thing, but let's try and get as many people from the niche as possible in on it, because it's more fun that way. We love ya. Keep reading, and remember, never trust a horse.